Welcome to another edition of the Health First Show. I'm your host, Dave Fuller, and today we're going to be talking about food. We're going to be talking with Vula Halliday in the first half of the show. We're going to be talking about gardening and getting kids involved in growing and growing their food. In the second half of the show, we'll be talking with Han Fischel about home for dinner. We'll be talking about why it's important to sit down with kids at dinner time, and we'll be talking about that. But before that, here's Reg with the health news.
A new study suggests people who down several cups of coffee every day may have a decreased risk of developing multiple sclerosis. The study of 5,600 Swedish and U.S. adults found those who drank 4 to 6 cups of coffee a day were about one-third less likely to develop multiple sclerosis compared with people who did not drink coffee. Researchers stress the findings do not prove coffee fights MS. Still, they say the findings do build on evidence that coffee, and possibly caffeine specifically, are neuroprotective, and note higher coffee intake has been linked to lower risks of other diseases that involve degeneration in brain cells, including Parkinson's disease and Alzheimer's. This year's flu vaccine is even more disappointing than previously reported. Health officials say reports show just 18% effectiveness against the dominant H3N2 strain of flu. Experts at the U.S. Center for Disease Control and Prevention say that's a drop from the 23% protection level estimated for the flu shot earlier in the season. The situation for children is even worse. The CDC panel pegged the effectiveness of the injected vaccine for kids aged 2 to 8 to be just 15%, and health officials say the nasal spray version of the vaccine may not protect young children at all. According to one center official, the H3N2 flu strain that is currently circulating was not factored into this season's vaccine because decisions about which strains to target were made last February. As happens each year, choices about which strains to include are made months in advance, so manufacturers have time to make enough vaccine. A British study has found a correlation between the amount of fluoride in public drinking water and a rise in incidence of underactive thyroid. While the study is only able to establish an association, not cause and effect, experts say the link deserves serious investigation. The new study from the University of Kent in Canterbury, England, compared 2012 national data on levels of fluoride in drinking water to trends for hypothyroidism as diagnosed by family physicians across England. They found in locales where tap water fluoride levels exceeded 0.3 milligrams per liter, the risk for having an underactive thyroid rose by 30%. The team also found hypothyroidism rates were nearly double in urbanized regions that had fluoridated tap water compared with regions that did not. The findings were published online February 23rd in the Journal of Epidemiology and Community Health. And finally, a new study suggests people with low levels of vitamin D appear to have an increased risk for type 2 diabetes, even if they aren't overweight or obese. The study included almost 150 people in Spain. Their vitamin D levels were checked, as was their body mass index. They also had tests for diabetes, prediabetes, or other blood sugar metabolism disorders. Obese people who didn't have diabetes or related disorders had higher vitamin D levels than those with diabetes. Lean people with diabetes or related disorders were more likely to have low vitamin D levels than those without such disorders. According to the study, the results show that vitamin D levels are more closely linked to blood sugar levels than BMI. The findings were published recently in the Endocrine Society's Journal of Clinical Endocrinology and Metabolism.
Hey, thanks for that, Reg. Our first guest, Vula Halliday, is a chef, a writer, and artist. She works in Toronto, and she helps out with Earth's Own Food Company and Slow Food Canada. Vula, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, Dave. It's such a pleasure to be here. I'm really excited about what you have on today. Both my bit and the second bit are really interesting topics for me and stuff that's close to my heart.
So tell us a little bit about, you know, how you got involved in working with kids and gardening.
It's been happening for a really long time for me. I think really when I was young, my parents were wonderful. They really let me play around in the kitchen. From pretty much the age of 7, I was given permission and carefully watched to play with fire and knives. And I learned a lot about food and about cooking for myself. And I also had to help around the house. So I cooked for my family too. That became something that felt really normal to me as I got older. So I was self-reliant when it came to that. And then I had my grandfather and other elders in my family who were sharing seeds with me from, believe it or not, so my grandfather would actually mail packages of seeds to us from Greece that we would plant here. It became a really exciting part of the year, knowing that those packages were going to show up in the mail.
Well, and how important is it for children to learn about getting involved, with gardening?
It's something that I think is actually crucial and critical. And a lot of people have talked recently about how they feel that their children, and this is, of course, especially happening. I live right in downtown Toronto, but they feel that their children are disconnected with nature or their exposure and their connection and their comfort level with the nature and the great outdoors and all that adventuring has diminished a little bit. So the bringing back opportunities for children to get involved in community gardening, it's important and special and adds value in many, many ways. For one thing, you are building and reinforcing a very healthy community connection. So you've got your parents and your teachers and maybe your local businesses involved. You're engaging grandparents or your community elders together in a process that respects the environment, that respects the process of taking something from seed to table. And of course, there's all that fun stuff. It's, so you're playing with soil. You're learning from each other. Your social interaction is huge there. You're growing healthy, nutritious food right where you live, and you're doing that together as a community by championing your environment and really by thinking in, it's an investment in your personal health and your well-being.
Have we lost have kids lost the ability to know where their food is coming from over the generations?
Absolutely, they have. I did, even with all the fantastic influence that I had in my life, when things that came along that were, microwavable, it was so easy to think, to go away from the value of the good food and the good health and think about the convenience. And for a moment, you can get pretty distracted, and that can become the focus of how you eat. So kids, I think, have a lot of that around them. They're experiencing food from a grocery store more often than they are from a farmer's market. We're lucky that now we're seeing more and more farmer's markets pop up and more sort of small food hubs pop up all around our cities and our communities. That and getting kids involved in that is probably a very good way to start that relationship and bring them back to a better sense of where food comes from. Food does not come from a Tetra Pak. Food has a much longer journey and history, and it has a culture as well attached to it. The way that we eat, the kinds of food that we eat, the way we have our morning, noon, and night meals, all of those things have come out of a long history that isn't really just something that you grab off the shelf.
I was going to ask you, I was watching a movie the other day and I was talking about the relationship between anxiety and the fact that we're not in touch with the earth anymore. Do you see that when you're working with these kids?
I do very much. And that's a thing about like not being able to slow down. And I think that, we're talking about knowing where your food comes from and gardening and socializing in that kind of environment. I really feel, it's fascinating. There's two sides of this, of course. There's the being active and involved in something as part of a group is really, really important. But how the mind responds to that and how the brain grows and engages and activates, like different parts of our brain are activated when we're using all of our senses and when we're participating in something with others around us. We're engaging at a much higher level. And, there are studies that show that the more that you do that, the better that you, the better that you can function, the more rested you feel at the end of the day. You've had fresh air. Let's talk about something that simple. I mean, it can be remove anxiety and remove, like, social situations that, you know, keep kids maybe inside a bit too much. But let's talk something really, really simple about just, you know, I'm outside, I'm having fun, and I don't have to think about anything else but the soil and playing around with it right now. That is so great for removing stress and for helping children connect to a sort of physical and interpersonal relationship with everything that's around them.
What about organic food? Is that really better for people?
There's so many benefits to organics. And in the simplest way, I would say absolutely it is better for you, because no matter how you slice it and no matter what opinion you have about organics, and the truth is that you're going to end up getting the maximum nutrient value you can get out of anything organic that you choose to eat. And the reason for that is because it's not genetically modified. So it doesn't have, like, a strawberry that is organic does not have a fish gene spliced into it. With genetically modified foods, you're ending up getting other species that have entered the food system. So, like I said, like, a strawberry will have something of a fish in it, and that's done in a lab because of there's a whole bunch of reasons why they do that. But with organic food, you're not getting that. You're not getting synthetic or artificial fertilizers. You're not getting pesticides or antibiotics or growth regulators or preservatives or dyes. So your strawberry is a strawberry is a strawberry. Your soy milk and soy especially is one of those that's so important. It's really been, if it's not organic, it's really been affected by different influences through the food system and how our food system has evolved. But you want that, you want to know with confidence that what you are putting in your body and what you're putting in your kid's body is really what it says it's going to be. And that, in its simplest way, for me, is, like, why I would prefer my food to be organic. It's also that it's a lot better for the planet. Anyone who works in an organic food system or is an organic farmer is supporting healthy practices overall. And those healthy practices end up translating into our own health and well-being. Our water is going to stay cleaner. So down the road, we're not looking at, for the next generations ahead, at looking at really polluted soil and really polluted water. We're optimizing biological productivity, and biodiversity is protected this way. There's so many things that are great about organics. But in its simplest form, like I said, organic is just knowing that, you know, when you're eating a strawberry, it's a strawberry. There's nothing else going on there.
We're talking with Vula Halliday. She's a chef, a writer, and an artist. And we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to be finding out more about how we can get better food on your plate.